supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. The National Republican Party has effectively disowned its candidate for a South Jersey congressional seat after new revelations that he shared racist views on his Facebook page. WHYY's Dave Davies reports.
Seth Grossman is a lawyer and former Atlantic City councilman who won the Republican primary to replace GOP Congressman Frank Lobiondo, who's retiring from the district that stretches from Gloucester to Atlantic City. Grossman made news last month when he expressed this opinion about the idea of diversity.
It is a bunch of crap, and it is un-American.
Grossman insisted he isn't prejudiced. He just wants people judged on their own merit. A new controversy arises because the group Media Matters discovered that in 2014, Grossman posted an article on his Facebook page from a publication that focuses on what it calls white identity. The author, who says he's a public defender, talks about blacks' criminal tendencies. He says they don't reason well or control their impulses and that they're, quote, a threat to all who cross their paths. Grossman says he posted the story without reading it carefully because it appeared on the Facebook page of a trusted source, conservative commentator Alan West.
Had I done it over again, I would have read it more carefully because there were some despicable racist comments in that piece, but I didn't see them at the time I shared it.
Grossman says he doesn't share those views. He posted the story because at the time he believed the Black Lives Matter movement had created a climate of hostility towards police.
So the purpose of sharing that article was to show that there's another side of the story, that many of the black teenagers, even though unarmed, were very, very violent and very, very dangerous, and that the police out in the street had to deal with some ugly situations.
The chairman of the National Republican Congressional Committee says bigotry has no place in Congress and suggests Grossman reconsider his candidacy. Grossman says the chairman should quit and the party should start backing true Trump supporters like him. The Democratic candidate for the seat, State Senator Jeff Van Drew, says the country has no place for white supremacy. As for Grossman's statement that the racist post was a careless mistake,
I would suggest probably in the future when you get a piece of information that you totally disavow and disagree with, that you send it back and express your distress and disagreement.
Asked if Grossman should get out of the race, Van Drew says he'll have to work that out with his party. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
Two 39-year-old men who spent most of their adult lives in prison for a murder they did not commit have won a $3 million settlement against the city of Philadelphia. As WHYY's Bobby Allen reports, a judge released the men from their life in prison sentences after another man in jail confessed to the murder.
After a North Philly man who ran a bar and seafood shop was robbed and gunned down in 1995, the neighborhood was shocked, and police had a hunch that teenage boys Gene Gilliard and Lance Felder were behind it. Witnesses say detectives pushed them around and kept saying, "Take a closer look," until they would admit that Gilliard and Felder did it. The seafood shop's daughter years later told detectives she glimpsed the two men through the blades of a motionless window fan from her apartment. She said the two men were running away from the murder scene. That evidence is what convinced the jury the two men were guilty, and they each spent 16 years in prison. Gilliard's family, though, didn't give up. They hired a private detective and found another man in jail for an unrelated murder who said he actually killed the business owner. Then the Pennsylvania Innocence Project got involved. Marissa Bluestein leads the group.
They will never fully recover. They will not be able to have that whole life that they had been looking for when they were so young.
A judge ended the life sentence given to the two men, and then they filed a civil rights lawsuit. It was just settled. Under the tentative $3 million deal, each man will get $900,000.
This does go a long way to helping to close that gap.
Lawyer Jules Epstein worked on the appeal of one of the men. He says picking out a suspect out of a series of mugshots has long been problematic. Memory, he says, often fails us when we need it most.
It certainly should have warranted a deeper look. Because anyone who went out to the murder scene, which I've done, and looked at where the eyewitness was, which I did, would have to question how much that person could have seen.
The Philadelphia Police Department says they now use double-blind photo arrays, where neither the witness nor the officer knows the real suspect. It's aimed at cutting down on witness misidentifications. Bobby Allen, WHYY News.
President Donald Trump's second selection to the Supreme Court, Brett Kavanaugh, is embarked on the first phase of his confirmation process, so-called courtesy visits with Senate members in advance of to-be-scheduled Judiciary Committee hearings. Paying us a courtesy visit to offer perspective is Dr. Anita Allen, University of Pennsylvania Vice Provost for Faculty and Professor of Law and Philosophy. Dr. Allen, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Everybody's trying to make sense of the Kavanaugh selection and what it might portend for the court. He's certainly an open book to the extent that he's already rendered some 300 decisions in his current capacity.
You're right. He is an open book. He's a candidate with a very long and public career in Washington, D.C. We know a lot about his written opinions, about his political associations, and about his likely proclivities regarding particular areas of law that we all care about.
And we also know about his endorsements from the Federalist Society and the Heritage Foundation. What can we make of that with regard to trying to portend where he might stand on many of the social issues of the day?
This is a man who has a deep history with the Republican Party and with the American right. He was someone who worked for Ken Starr with respect to the Clinton impeachment. He's worked in the White House, in the Bush White House. He has been part of the effort to deal with the controversial Florida elections that gave us George Bush in the second administration. So he's a Republican, and he's a right-leaning Republican. On the other hand, I have heard him described as a mere bread-and-butter, routine Republican who is right of center, but not an extremist on anything.
Admittedly, a small sample size, but to date, Neil Gorsuch has not offered much of a surprise, and he, again, like Kavanaugh, have both received this Federalist Society grooming and endorsement. Does that offer a glimpse of how Kavanaugh might be on the court?
Well, you know, Kavanaugh is something of a wunderkind. I mean, he was appointed to the D.C. Court of Appeals at the age of 38, and he's now only in his 50s. He has a long career ahead of him. He's a Catholic school product. He has been involved with Republican causes. He has impeccable right-wing credentials. Of course, the Federalist Society and the Heritage Foundation and so forth would be inclined to support him. But I think that it would have been unlikely that any judge that President Trump nominated would not have received the endorsement of those organizations, that their job is to be a strong voice in favor of candidates that we know the Democrats and the liberals are going to be in opposition to. That's just sort of now become part of our political landscape and part of our expectations.
Dr. Allen, just because you cited the term wunderkind, I will ask about what many decry as the homogenization of the members in terms of their backgrounds. They all seem to be either Yale or Harvard backgrounds. And as you two came from Harvard, I guess you looked down your nose at Yale, but still there's something to be said for that degree as well.
Yes. So Judge Kavanaugh is a Yale-y, true and true. I think he bleeds blue. He went to Yale undergrad. He went to Yale Law School. He then clerked for several judges, including the notorious and disgraced Judge Kaczynski on the Ninth Circuit. I haven't heard much conversation about that. Then he went on to clerk for Justice Kennedy. But yeah, I mean, he's a very bright man with a very distinctly Republican, right-leaning history, and someone who could be expected to be very sympathetic to right causes, but not necessarily a puppet. And I think for the Democrats, the challenge is, if they're going to oppose him, find grounds for opposition that are really meaningful.
Since the Robert Bork hearings, selectees have been groomed to be circumspect, shall we say, in terms of revealing how they might rule in a case. If you had the honor of serving on the Judiciary Committee hearings, what question or questions might you broach that you could get an answer to that would be revealing for you?
Well, I think that I would want to ask about the judges' opinions on the doctrine of substantive due process. This is a 14th Amendment doctrine that's been used in cases involving abortion and gay rights, the right to die, and some other matters. I'd ask him about his theories of interpretation, about his understanding of the role of the judge. And in answering those questions, I think he might reveal aspects of himself that would give us a pretty good hint as to how he would regard, for example, the balance between government and the private sector, the public and the private, the citizen and the state, the woman and her body. I think that you can get some inferences from how people answer questions about their judicial philosophy, how they might think about particular matters that might come before the court.
That's Dr. Anita Allen, University of Pennsylvania Vice Provost for Faculty and Professor of Law and Philosophy.
Thank you so much for having me.
Democrats in the New Jersey Assembly have introduced a bill requiring all public school students in middle and high school to be trained in administering naloxone, the overdose reversal drug. WHYY's Nina Feldman reports.
More than 1,500 people have died of suspected overdoses so far this year in New Jersey. More than four times as many people were given naloxone, the opioid overdose reversal drug. That means without the drug, the number of overdose deaths could have been as high as 6,000. That's what motivated Assemblywoman Yvonne Lopez of Perth Amboy to write a bill that would require all students in grades 7 to 12 learn to recognize the signs of an overdose and how to administer naloxone. Juan Carlos Nordello is Lopez's legislative director. He says the training this bill would require is responding to the times.
There are situations in which a parent might be experiencing an overdose, a grandparent, another student that they know. And our students need to know how to recognize the signs of an overdose, to contact a first responder, and should the opioid antidote be available, how to safely administer that treatment.
Critics say teaching students about naloxone could motivate young people to experiment, that understanding it's possible to come back from an overdose would prompt them to use opioids.
Quite frankly, the Assemblywoman believes that that argument is sort of reductive. Teaching students how to administer naloxone does not in any way normalize or enable drug use. It teaches students how to respond to an emergency situation.
The bill is in its very early stages and has been referred to the Assembly's Education Committee. While many states have laws requiring naloxone be stocked in schools, it's less common to require schools to train students in administering the drug. Nina Feldman, WHYY News.
To date, at least 27 people have died in the Democratic Republic of Congo from an Ebola outbreak that began in April. The last Ebola epidemic, which took place from 2014 to 2016, left more than 11,000 people dead, including two in the United States. To prepare for the possibility of Ebola or another deadly disease, hospitals hold drills to practice protocols intended to keep staff and patients safe. For WHYY, Sarah Bowden attended one of these drills at UPMC's Presbyterian Hospital in Pittsburgh and has this story.
An ambulance pulls up and a pair of EMTs unload a portable isolation pod, basically a human-sized medical-grade Ziploc bag. Inside the pod is professional actor Parag S. Goel. Goel's not really sick, but he does a convincing job. He looks sweaty and uncomfortable. All other ambulances are being diverted because Goel is pretending to be infected with some sort of highly contagious disease. It's part of a drill that includes EMTs, law enforcement, and UPMC medical staff. Before wheeling Goel inside, two nurses clean the outside of the pod with disposable bleach wipes. I watched the action with Dr. Gavin Harris.
They're trying to use it as another kind of infection control measure, as another barrier, so to speak.
Does wiping those down really make that much of a difference?
To be honest, we don't really know, but we're kind of doing everything we can. They're bleach, so our hope is that any sort of little thing we can do might be able to help.
Harris is in the second year of a dual fellowship in critical care and infectious disease. The nurses, who are dressed in what look like poorly fitting spacesuits, transport Goel into a room with a special ventilation system that filters the air and funnels it directly outside. They help him out of the isolation pod, make sure he's comfortable, take some vital signs and blood samples. These routine tasks are more difficult because the suits hinder a person's dexterity.
I think they've done a great job, especially adapted. One of the earpieces came out earlier. So they've had to resort to hand signals or lip reading and things like that, which is great simulations for real-world exercises.
Everything seems to be going well, but Goel's not out of the woods yet.
I don't feel good.
He's handed a cup of fake vomit made with crumbled bagel, Pepsi, lemonade, and cranberry juice, which gives it a reddish hue. Goel then tosses this mixture onto the floor while retching. The nurses spring into action to clean it up. Red vomit indicates possible internal bleeding. Bill Pascal is the director of UPMC's clinical microbiology labs.
Blood of a patient with Ebola contains 10 million virus particles in every milliliter of blood. It's very highly infectious.
Well, how would that compare to, like, me having, like, the flu or something?
That's 1,000 times more.
This might all seem over the top. Fake patient, fake vomit, fake diagnostic tests. But Jackie Stang, a staff nurse who's doing this training for the second time, says practice is important in case someone with a serious disease like Ebola ever came to UPMC for treatment.
I feel much more confident in knowing what to do if something like this were to occur than not being trained, and God forbid something like this did happen in Pittsburgh, and not knowing what to do.
I'm Sarah Bowden in Pittsburgh.
Common Space wrapped up its second broadcast season on WHYY this past Sunday night. But you can still subscribe and hear all the episodes online at Apple Podcast and Stitcher. The final Common Space podcast, The Storytelling Mind, features a roundtable of some of our favorite storytellers discussing their process and their experiences of sharing their stories. Host Jamie Jay asked each in turn about the most personally difficult thing they've ever talked about on stage. For frequent performer Chris Lundy, who normally brings the funny in his stories, there was one exception.
When I was a child, I was responsible, at least, you know, for years, I blamed myself. I was responsible for the kidnap of my best friend.
Here's that very story from the First Person Arts Archives.
Growing up as a kid, I was like the king of my little friends group. It was like five or six of us, and I ruled with an iron fist. Even like if it was the games that we were going to play, let's play hide and go seek. No, we already played that. Let's play red light, green light, da-da-da. And they're arguing, and I'm like, enough. Today we will play freeze tag. And they'll be like, yeah, freeze tag. That's right, Chris. Silence. Not it. So, I mean, I was the king, right? But being the king came with a lot of responsibility. And I remember one day we were hanging out, and a nice lady came up to us, and she's talking to us, she's asking us questions, and then she tells us that she's Lamont's mother. And I know that Lamont lived with his father, Big Lamont, they look just alike, and he lived with his stepmother as well. So to meet Lamont's mother, it was like, oh my God, Lamont's mother, like we were really excited about it. And she was telling us that she was visiting, and she wanted to surprise Lamont. So if we could help by going to get him, bringing him outside, and she would be like, you know, hey, Lamont, and it would, you know, all happy. So we were excited about this. So I go, you know, knock on the door, can Lamont come out and play? So Lamont comes out, and I'm just giddy. I'm like, Lamont, you have no idea the surprise we have in store for you. So we walk up, and we come around the corner, and, you know, my friends are standing there with Lamont's mother, and she goes, hey, Lamont. And Lamont is just standing there. And we're like, yo, what's going on? And she's like, how you been? And he isn't saying anything. And he looks like scared. And before we knew it, she grabs Lamont. And she grabs him by the neck. And you could see his shoulders kind of tense up from the pressure that she was putting on his neck. And we're in shock. We don't know what's going on. And she pulls him to her car and throws him in and drives off. And we're frozen. And my friends are looking at me, and I'm frozen too. But then something kicked in, and I tell one of my buddies, go get Big Lamont, and I break. I start running because in this apartment complex, cars had to go around the buildings and around the bend and then drive down the straightaway to get out of the complex, whereas if you were on foot, you could cut behind and get to the exit way, if you will, before the car could. So I'm booking, and my friends are booking right behind me, and we beat the car there. It's kind of gravel in that area, and I pick up rocks, and I'm just throwing them at the cars, and my friends are throwing them at the car as well. and we're hitting it, but it was no good. I mean, well, I don't know what we were trying to do. Maybe bust a window, or I don't know what the goal was, but the car ended up getting away. And we had to tell Big Lamont what happened, and, you know, we filed a police report, and I felt terrible. I felt responsible for the kidnapping of my friend Lamont. It turns out his mother had lost custody and visitation rights. She was out of his life completely. And Lamont was gone. And I remember a month went by and no Lamont. 2 months went by and no Lamont. And I remember not wanting to go outside because I didn't want to run into Big Lamont. And I didn't want to run into his stepmother because I felt like it was my fault and I wouldn't be able to look him in the eye. I remember not really going outside. I didn't want to play. I didn't want to be the leader of the little crew around the neighborhood or anything like that anymore. And it was 4 months before they finally found and recovered Lamont. And I was relieved, but I wasn't really happy because even though he was back, he had lost 4 months and who knows what was happening to him. Who knows what that lady, his mother, was doing to him. We didn't know. I didn't know. And so I felt the guilt. You have no idea. And I felt that way until we found out that part of what happened and how the cops found the car, it was a Honda Accord, actually. It was a dark gray Honda Accord. Everybody had a dark gray Honda Accord back then, so it was impossible to just go by the car and find it. But the cops were looking for it, and what happened was they saw the car, and they remembered the police report with all the rocks, and this car was pelted, dented all up, and even the back rear window, you know, the little triangle, that little thing, even that was cracked from the rocks that we were all throwing, and that's what tipped them off. And just that little bit of relief, oh my God, I did something right, because if I hadn't chased, that wouldn't have happened, and if my friends wouldn't have chased with me, and if I wouldn't have started throwing rocks, they wouldn't have done it either. So I started feeling, you know, at least a little bit better, at least better enough to go outside and play again, and you know, hold my head up high. I guess I got my confidence back. And I remember it was the same types of arguments, you know, like, what game are we going to play? What are we going to do? And I remember the kids, you know, we were all talking about it, trying to decide. And I remember them looking at me again to decide. It was like I was back, and we were back as a crew.
Chris Lundy is a writer and performer who also hosts First Person Arts Story Slams. Common Space is a collaboration between First Person Arts and WHYY. Subscribe at Apple Podcasts and Stitcher to hear all of the podcasts from both seasons. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on your favorite podcast app or listen back at whyy.org/news. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.